Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. I am Dan Favalli, coming at you this time with my super-duper esteemed, incredibly awesome, times awesome, absolutely spectacular co-host, Andy Bailey.
That was like an avalanche of superlatives. Continue.
I had to get them all in because you weren't here last week when we did our two pods. And two things. I'm happy to see that you survived your law school finals, even though it sounds like you might be a little bit worse for wear. We were talking about off the air how you lost your voice mid-radio spot earlier today. And two, in your absence, I don't know if you realize this because I'm sure you listened, but I had two attorneys on. Grant Hughes, attorney, but also a writer for Bleacher Report, a colleague of mine for the better part of a decade at this point. And then we had Cole Zewicker, co-founder and writer for The Stepien, who is also an attorney. And I didn't plan it that way, but I was doing the intro with Cole, and I realized I was like, oh, crap. Like, Andy's out because of law school, and I just brought on two like active attorneys. And I thought that that was – I don't know. I thought that was very good synergy between me and the reason that you were absent.
Absolutely. I also have a bone over the shout-outs at the end of the podcast.
What's that?
I also have a bone to pick with you over the end of the podcast shout-outs.
Oh, but I have no idea what you're talking about, so we're going to move on. Before we get started, I just want to remind everyone to please rate, subscribe, and review us on iTunes. You have no idea how much that helps us out, how much we appreciate it. Andy and I have a dream that we will one day soon get to 100 ratings and or reviews on iTunes, and we're the better part of halfway there, and we want to thank everyone who's done it. But if you can take the 10 to 15 seconds to just go on and hit those 5 stars and maybe submit a review if you're feeling kind of spunky, we would be forever in your debt. And I speak for the two of us when I say that. Today we're going to be talking about All-Star rosters, since the voting kicks off on December 21st, just a couple days from when we're recording this. And Andy and I will eventually have a draft later on this year where we each pick our own rosters, but we're going to wait until, you know, the representatives and everything are set. Like the NBA, we won't be televising the draft because we apparently hate fun just as much as the NBA. But I did want to start with today. Adrian Wojnarowski over at ESPN.com published what seems to be like this annual, like, let's check in with Anthony Davis and the Pelicans piece about where they're at. And I'm just going
to... He also likes to check in with the Celtics a lot.
Yes, the Celtics. And then there's also, it seems like the Giannis Antetokounmpo Bucks thing is like sort of a trend now. So Woj writes, Davis remains an obsession of several NBA teams full of the necessary trade assets to unfasten him from New Orleans should the Pelicans ever consider a rebuild, or should Davis ever request a trade. Boston has remained vigilant on the possibility of acquiring Davis, and Davis knows it. However, the Pelicans have no intention of trading an all-world talent under contract through 2021, no matter the return. What that essentially means is that unless Davis requests a trade, the Pelicans don't seem like they're going to move toward even discussing it at the moment. But Davis did say this to Woj. He told me that Boston was calling, but nothing was going to happen, Davis said. And this is him going to approach Del Demps about the Celtics trade rumors. At the same time, Davis continued, though you see how organizations treat players. Isaiah Thomas, DeMarcus Cousins told me that the Kings told him that he wasn't going to get traded, but then they traded him. Isaiah took his team to the Eastern Conference Finals, and they traded him. It makes you wonder, does this organization really have my back? I've been loyal to this organization. I love it here. I love this team. I think we're moving in the right direction. DeMarcus, Rondo, some of the other players that are helping us, but people get judged on winning, and I want to win. So before, I'm just going to throw it to you really quick, but before I do, I just want to say, it's hysterical to me that the primary threat everyone believes to acquire Davis from the Pelicans is a team that he kind of throws shade at because they traded Isaiah Thomas after he got them to the Eastern Conference Finals. So speaking of whether an organization has your back, you might end up playing for that organization. It's just, you can't make this stuff up. So that's just really funny to me.
Yeah, that is pretty funny. I also think it's interesting that he's kind of like projecting the shortcomings of the Celtics and the Kings onto the team he's currently on. It's definitely an interesting situation. And I don't you think they'd be more likely to trade Cousins than Anthony Davis, like if it came to it. They like Woj says in the piece, they've got him under contract through 2021. I don't see what the rush would be.
Well, there's none. And the thing is that...
You said before we were recording that like to get to the money needed to send Davis to the Celtics under the cap rules, you laid out Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Aaron Baines, and I think you had Morris in there too.
Yeah, so if you don't...
And that's a lot of young talent, but is it like potentially a top five player like Anthony Davis is? I don't think it's an impending sort of thing right now.
No, and it's... So I believe he has a player option before 2020, 2021, right? So you have effectively not only this season, but next season to kind of play through before you have to worry about that. And I get that there's...
The returns will still be there if you wait a couple of years.
Right.
He gets, like, terribly injured.
Which, you know, you can't necessarily... Oh, and you can't necessarily discount it. If... And Mason Ginsburg over at Bourbon Street Shots has basically said, he told us this on the season preview pod, if DeMarcus Cousins leaves and you're not able to make subsequent moves in free agency this summer, maybe that's when you look at it, just because in theory you are going to get a lot more money, a lot better of a return for a superstar that has 2 years left on his deal before free agency as opposed to just one. But
yeah, that's true.
When we're talking about Anthony Davis, who's a top five player, you're still going to get a ton for that 1 year and to have his bird rights and to have the ability to offer him more money than anybody else. I don't think that it would curtail offers specifically from a team like the Celtics very much. Where that becomes an issue probably is if we're talking about, and I'm just throwing these teams out there, I'm not saying any of them necessarily should go after Davis, but ones that aren't going to be necessarily confident in their ability to re-sign him. We saw it kind of with the Denver Nuggets and the Paul George rumors last year, or maybe the Phoenix Suns. That's probably why they didn't go all in on a Kyrie Irving trade as well. So you kind of, I guess, lose offers from that team. But this isn't something you consider, to me, before the middle of next season. And for me, I mean, if someone comes with a monster offer, and that's the question I want to ask you, is could you think of any offer right now that even get the Pelicans to even just think for like a minute? And you can munch on that while I'm going through this little ramble. But if the Celtics are considered the best trade partner, we just outlined, unless the Pelicans want to take back Al Horford, like you have to give up way too much. Or take on too many players and like it just becomes this mishmash. And if I'm the Pelicans, Al Horford's great, but he's over 30 and he's owed almost $60 million in the 2 years after this one, assuming he opts into the final year of his deal. That's not necessarily how you want to start your rebuild. He's going to add wins. So you're either looking at getting a third team involved. It just might be better for them to wait until it's better for the Celtics, in my opinion, because then maybe you don't have to give up Al Horford. If you're going to be able to sign Marcus Smart to just a more expensive deal this summer, and you can use him as salary matching fodder. No, the Pelicans won't necessarily want him, but as long as the deal isn't ridiculous, you know, you can overpay him a lot for, let's say, 2 or 3 years, and it's fine, or you can give him a market level-ish deal over 4 or 3, and then that's like your salary matching right there. So, and that'll help you keep Al Horford. And if I'm the Pelicans, you're probably more interested than that, I would think, as well. So I can't imagine this becoming a real issue unless Davis acts out before the middle of next year.
Yeah, I can't really imagine it either. Like I said earlier, the Celtics are interesting if they were willing to pony up all of those young assets like we laid out. And while you were talking, I thought, man, a Kyrie Irving, Marcus Smart, Gordon Hayward, Anthony Davis, Al Horford starting five, that's pretty crazy for next season. And I have no worries about Brad Stevens being able to like still have a workable bench, even with all that money devoted to the starting lineup. I'm convinced that he could turn like anybody into a rotation NBA player. So I think they would be fine depth-wise. I was also just kind of scanning the standings while you were talking, trying to think of anybody else who might be able to go get him. And the only other team that kind of makes sense to me is the Lakers. Like, they might have a couple of the pieces necessary to go after a big name like that. And they actually have some salary filler too, especially like next season as some of those bad contracts age one more year. You know, would New Orleans be interested in a deal that included like Ingram and salary filler and a first, and I don't know, maybe one or two other young players. That's really the only other team I see that's even like a possibility right now.
Yeah, I think that you could probably build something there. I don't know how the Pelicans would feel. Maybe if you're getting Kuzma and Brandon Ingram as part of that.
Yeah, I almost said those two, actually.
Maybe you're not as worried about not having, because the pick can't convey until 2020. Okay. Because there are other selections owed to Philly or Boston this year. But maybe if you're getting, you know, Ingram and Kuzma as part of that deal with filler, it works.
And then you're hoping, if you're the Lakers, like maybe this is more attractive to LeBron now that we have Anthony Davis.
I would bet that. But then you're also losing, because you're not getting rid of Luol Deng as part of this deal.
That's what I was saying. Like, it would have to be
Clarkson. Deng's
got a couple years left. I was saying, like, it would have to be a year or two from now for the Lakers, in my opinion. Because then Deng and Mozgov's contracts are more movable.
Right. And so that's, you know, right now their best offer would probably be, if you include a first-round pick with Clarkson, Ingram, and Kuzma, that's probably their best. You know, I don't know that.
Is that enough?
No, I'm not saying to get the – oh, salary-wise for Davis? It should be. I'm going to run it right now really quick. It is – No, so you'd have to cut another $300,000 from there. So I mean, you have Corey Brewer's expiring deal.
Yeah, there's Tyler Ennis.
You throw Larry Nance in there. But I just don't, you know. But then yes, you get rid of Clarkson there. But now all of a sudden you've lost all of your primary sweeteners to get rid of Deng's deal. So you're looking at stretching Deng, which is assuming a splash is the plan, is to make a splash in free agency. So they would be a team. But the other thing to consider, too, is, like, look at what the Pelicans are kind of left with if they trade Anthony Davis now. Like, you have another 4 years left on that Drew Holiday contract. And who's taking that? Like, we're talking about, it's like $105 million left on it after this season. So I don't know. It's a little bit more than $105 million he has left after this season. So, that deal's not necessarily movable. Maybe it becomes a little bit more movable in a year when there's only three. I honestly don't know. So, would they, and the answer to me would be no, but, like, do they kind of consider this, like, weirdo straddling route where they're getting some future assets, but it's also kind of angled at – it's almost like the Kyrie Irving return, where you're trying to stay like relevant now and toe the line for the future. And I don't know what team would like really help them do
I don't think they're anywhere near relevant now. I guess they still have Cousins.
Right. Saying it's like the plan is to kind of rebuild around Cousins, maybe. But again, I don't know what team would necessarily help them do that.
I have a feeling he wouldn't want to stay either if Davis was gone.
I think for him, the bird rights might like kind of matter, though, just because he was supposed to get that like monster deal from the Kings that never came, and like to kind of have that dangled in front of you only to see it.
Last question on this. If he did, let's say Davis did ask for a trade within like the next month, things just go horribly bad. If you're the Pelicans, would you rather have Kuzma, Ingram, Clarkson, and Brewers expiring, or the Celtics deal that you laid out before we started recording, which I think was Tatum, Jaylen Brown, Marcus Morris, and Aaron Baines?
And I included the
there probably have to be picks for.
I would think the Philly or the Philly or the Lakers selection, I think, would have to be included. And I would rather have that package because it's more geared towards a rebuild. And I mean, depending on how, you could still keep DeMarcus Cousins in that scenario, and you're at least a deeper team, you know.
Yeah.
The other thing that, and this is like, it's probably on the low end, but if we're talking about them like trying to kind of straddle two timelines, like, do you build something with the Bucks around Middleton, McCurr, Wilson, Brogdon? And there could probably be other stuff in there too. If you're looking at, if you want them to like take on a Ginsa, they probably would, and maybe they can send you back like Teletovic or something, and you could hope that you hit on him if he's healthy. I don't, and they could, their pick, like, they have such wonky protections on this season's pick. So, your first round pick, if you got one from them, it's not going to be until well down the line. Would the Bucks consider that? I'm sure the Bucks would, but is that, you know, you would have to really believe in McCurr. You'd have to be kind of high on DJ Wilson, and you'd have to think that Middleton and Brogdon kind of help you remain relevant in the West now. And I think that that's on a low ball of the spectrum, but if you're looking to go that path where you, hey, we don't want to hit completely reset because we have, like, because think of how hard it will be for them, because losing Davis in a vacuum sucks, but like now at this moment you have two top 10, top 15, whatever you want to say about Cousins guys, and Davis and Cousins. To have two of them and all of a sudden just pivot into this full tilt rebuild would absolutely suck.
Yeah. It would be tough for sure. But I don't think it's imminent.
You don't think there's any deal could the Celtics deal get the Pelicans to think about it now? Not as quickly as saying no. Like they call and you hang up. Is there anything that could just even get them to remotely think about it right now?
I actually think both of those Lakers and Celtics deals we laid out are semi-interesting. I'd still say no if I was the Pelicans unless he's pushing for a trade, but I both of those packages have some really interesting young players.
Do you know which team could become kind of relevant next year? I would think would be the Nuggets in an Anthony Davis sweepstakes.
See, I'm just not like the Nuggets have tried so many different variations of like two big guys and one of them being Jokic, and it never seems to click quite like Jokic and just a pure stretch four like Gallinari.
I guess
like,
that's
to
fair.
Me, that was the most
Davis.
Obvious. I know that's true. that's a great point. Anthony Davis is obviously at a different level than Paul Millsap or Yusuf Nurkic. So that's very, very fair.
Because you have Gary Harris's extension, kind of kicks in, and he'll still be semi young, and you still have Jamal Murray.
Jamal Murray could be dealt. Yeah.
Emmanuel Mudiay. It would be interesting. It would be
Trey Lyles is rehabbing his trade value this year.
And it would be interesting just because he would only have next year and the season after left on his deal. Yes, he's old, but Paul Millsap, let's bring him home. He's born in Monroe, Louisiana.
Yeah, I think he played for Louisiana Tech too.
Yes,
didn't
he did.
Same school as Malone.
But that's then you're all of a sudden you're screwing over your draft odds. But they would be a team I would think next year could get involved. You would probably they're someone who would have to. Maybe that's why you kind of the Nuggets could use help now, but maybe that's one of the reasons why you wouldn't trade a pick this year, because you'd probably have to give up, knowing where you are, two future firsts to get Davis. On the other hand, you have Paul Millsap with Jokic, and
I'm still not ready to give up on that.
And it's not even that, but it's
they were starting to play better before Millsap got hurt.
Right, and it's not even that, but you're not the Pelicans probably aren't going to want Paul Millsap, and then you don't want Paul Millsap, Davis, and Jokic on the same team. That just takes the whole.
That's true.
I don't think it's gonna happen this season. I think the Celtics are the only team that could get the Pelicans to maybe possibly think about it. And the only way they think about it, aside from obviously Davis requesting out, which I don't think that he would do. Maybe if Cousins leaves and that's just the final straw, and maybe they've missed the playoffs or they just got destroyed in the first round this year, maybe. But the Pelicans would have to have kind of a good inkling that they don't think Cousins is coming back, or that they don't want him to come back, before they'd consider anything right now. And I'm not entirely convinced that they would move him before next season or during next season. They just might decide to, we'll trade him on a 1-year deal. The superstar market hasn't been that great anyway. You look at I would say the Cavaliers did pretty well for Irving, but it looks a little bit different now when the Nets, that pick is slated to be 10th. Right now, around 10th right now. So that trade looks a little different. The Timberwolves and the Bulls, that trade for Jimmy Butler still doesn't look fantastic, even with Chris Dunn breaking out and Lauri Markkanen looking okay to have started the year before entering kind of a slump. So I wouldn't be shocked if they did it before the summer of 2019, but I do think that they might, it'd be easier for them to make a splash in the summer of 2019. So let's say they can't replace DeMarcus Cousins this summer, which you have Drew Holiday on the books, you have Solomon Hill and Ashik on the books. There's more. You have a Jinsa for one more year. It's going to be a little bit harder. Fast forward to 2019, if you haven't taken on any big money after Cousins leaves, yes, that might have been a hard year, but maybe you're able to make kind of a splash in free agency then and figure out ways to get rid of Ashik, who will only have the 1 year left on his deal. Same with Solomon Hill and Etuan Moore. All those salaries become, although I think Moore is actually a good player, but all those salaries become much easier to dump, and maybe that's when you make your splash. So I would still lean, and just knowing how hard it is to get a top five player. I know you don't want to lose him for nothing, but to have someone like that and to trade him with more than a year left on his deal just kind of stings to me.
Yep. Should we jump into All-Stars?
Yeah, I think that's enough on the Anthony Davis run. I didn't mean to burst the Celtics fans' bubbles. Imagine their surprise when they found out that they can't trade their disabled player exception for Anthony Davis straight up, because there's just many things illegal about that deal.
They wouldn't believe you even if you told them.
So how do you – I guess we'll start with you, and do we want to start with – I'm going to leave it just completely up to you. We'll start with you, and we'll go east or west, whatever you want to do.
So like you said, voting starts on December 21st. Are they going to mix east and west with this draft?
I think – isn't the eligible pool of players going to be even – it'll be even from both conferences.
Like it'll still
and then you'll
be,
pick from,
okay.
It'll, yeah.
Okay, that's kind of what I assume. So we will have 12 All-Stars from each conference. Let's start with no-brainers from the West. And I am going to go – I think the no-brainers in the Western Conference are James Harden, Stephen Curry, and Kevin Durant. And I am going to leave it at that.
I agree James Harden's a no-brainer. I agree Kevin Durant's a no-brainer. Stephen Curry, for me, I think he's a no-brainer when you're looking at specifically the fan vote. How much time will he have missed, though, by that point?
I guess if he doesn't come back before the All-Star break, it does get kind of...
Well, not even that, but just like if he misses, you know, like 15 games because of this sprained right ankle... That's kind of an issue. I would put him – I mean, he's been fantastic. I would put
he was him, arguably like the – he was probably the third best player in the league before he got hurt, right?
Yes, I would absolutely agree with that. So I would if he comes back on the expected timeline where it's, he's supposed to be reevaluated, it was 2 weeks, and now that should be down to – actually, it's been 2 weeks, hasn't it? Isn't it like 2 weeks to the day? December 19th, that update that came on – December 4th. So if he's going to come
just
back
about there, yeah.
If he's going to come back soon, and we're going to get an update later today, so this podcast will be outdated really quickly, it looks like. If he's going to come back soon, relatively close to the timeline, he's a no-brainer for me. And I think, even though people aren't talking about him, Anthony Davis, speaking of Anthony Davis again.
Yeah, I was going to say, he's probably a no-brainer too.
He's a no-brainer to enter the starters pool for me, because it's just, I mean, I'm just going to read his line this season. 25.2 points per game, 10.6 rebounds, 2.6 assists, 1.1 steals, 2 blocks, 56.9% shooting, and a career-high 34.9% shooting from beyond the arc on 1.7 attempts per game, which isn't, like, incredible, but it's still, you know, it's still a pretty big
something
deal.
Yeah,
it's like right in line with his career. It ties his career high per 36 minutes. He's at 1.8 per 36 minutes. He's done that twice before in each of the two previous seasons, actually. So it's just he's kind of keeping the same volume, and he's just hitting them at a clip that's closer to league average. He has been absolutely sensational, and when you look at the Pelicans numbers with him on the court when Cousins isn't playing, they're actually a net plus per 100 possessions, and Cousins can't say the same without him. So that I know people don't necessarily take on-off numbers into account, but he's been – like Cousins' lines I think look a little bit more ridiculous sometimes, in part because he's going to get you more assists. But Davis is the most valuable player on this roster, and it's not even up for debate.
Yeah, he's actually my fourth starter in addition to those three no-brainers that I have. Do you know what Kim Durant's done since Stephen Curry went down?
I know that it's absolutely absurd, even including now, that kind of misfire fest he had versus the Lakers the other night.
Yeah, so he was 10 of 29 against the Lakers, and his line is still, in five games post Stephen Curry, 34.2 points, 10.4 rebounds, 7.4 assists, 3 blocks, 49.2% from the field, 41% from 3, and 94.3% from the line.
He's just unreal.
Yeah, it's insane. The assist number is what really blows my mind. 7.5 assists. I mean, that line carried out over a whole season would be like just slightly above a LeBron type of raw stat line. So that's he's an obvious no-brainer to me. My fifth starter.
Who's also my fifth starter, so we just might as well loop that together.
Okay. This is one I was a little torn about. And I went with Cousins here, too. First of all, it's like kind of weird to have two starters from a team that's 15-15. But we've talked about this on this podcast before. It's like those two are legitimately just amazing. It's the supporting cast that's really, I think, making them a 500 team. And his like raw box score numbers are insane too. He is averaging, let's see, 26 points, 12 rebounds, 5 assists, 1.5 steals and 1.5 blocks. And his true shooting, I was going to say his efficiency leaves a little bit to be desired, but it really doesn't, because his true shooting is 58, which is, I mean, 60 is kind of the magic number. So he's right there. He's been unreal. I think I have to give it to him despite them not being like a world beater as a team.
Yeah. And I playing in New Orleans, maybe it hurts just because that's such a tiny market. It's like, I don't know what the 50% of the fan vote's going to look like. I don't know how popular he is among players, and he's certainly not popular among some media members. So just looking at, you know, factoring those in, I think that's where he's – I think the first four, unless Stephen Curry is just not healthy, are no-brainers, but he's kind of just the up in the air. But output alone, he's just been absolutely fantastic. And his defense seems like it's kind of – regressed from the point that it was at the start of the season, where he seemed to be a little bit more engaged on a regular basis. But he's just been all out great as well. And it, like you said, it would be weird. The Pelicans are basically the definition of mediocrity at this point, and they're going to have two all-stars. But those guys are they're nuts. Like, they're absolutely nuts.
Yeah, they've just been ridiculous this season. All right, I'm going to give you my first reserve. I'm waiting for a search to pull up here. Okay. this is even a little different than I expected. among players with 200 minutes played this season, do you know who the top two are in win shares per 48?
How many minutes?
Entire NBA. 200 minutes. Actually, let's go top three.
I honestly have no idea. Is James crazy. Harden one of them?
So top three in win shares per 40. Yeah, he is one. Minimum 200 minutes. Number one in the league, Chris Paul. Number two in the league, James Harden. Number three in the league, Clint Capella.
The Rockets have just been like absolutely ridiculous.
Isn't that insane? It took me a while to get there, but my first reserve is Chris Paul. I know he missed a bunch of time. He's only played 15 games now that I'm looking at this, but Houston is 15-0 in games that he started. despite the fact that he's only played 15 games, he's already 22nd in the NBA, the entire league, and wins over a replacement player, which is just, that's nutty. He's going to continue to climb that board as he continues to play games. His raw stat line is 18 points, 9 assists, 5 rebounds, 2 steals, with a .632 true shooting percentage. I think by the time we get to All-Star Weekend, the amount of games he's missed will matter a little bit less. The fact that he's already 22nd in a cumulative stat with all that time missed is just insane. So he's got to be on the team for me.
Right, and it helps that he's reserved, so like we're not trying to predict him as a starter. So he'll get hurt initially, like by the votes, just because when the voting opens, he's not going to have played that much. But
yeah,
by the time the coaches go to make their picks. Do you know what the Rockets' offensive rating is with Chris Paul on the floor for 472 minutes, which is not an insubstantial sample?
Yeah, it's getting up there.
It actually makes him, I think, their eighth most used player. So, you know, that's not insubstantial. Can you guess what their offensive rating is with him?
I feel like I checked this a few days ago. I'm going to say like 118.
120.4.
So I even undershot it.
I had him as well, so I will move on to my second reserve. I have Damian Lillard, who has been, I think, absolutely spectacular this year. I guess one of the knocks would be that the Blazers have not been that great on the offensive end. They ranked 20th in points scored per 100 possessions, but they're fifth in defensive rating. They're fifth in points allowed per 100 possessions, and he plays a ton of minutes for them. His defense has picked up this year. It doesn't seem like he's dying on as many screens, and it seems like he's just a little bit smarter when he's leading guys into the paint. And I think it also helps, of course, that the conservative system that Terry Stotts runs is kind of like player friendly. Like, if you can just, as long as you have guys who are going to like protect the rim on the inside, and the Blazers, wow, have carved out enough of that for this season, I think that that's an incredibly big deal. And, you know, not for nothing, but they're probably closer to a league average offensive team when he's on the floor. 104.2 points per 100 possessions. Again, nothing really spectacular, but it would put you like right around that 15th, 16th area, which, if you're going to have an elite defense, fine. And he's still Damian Lillard, like, yeah, on the offensive end, even though the rest of the team isn't. And that team doesn't really have a lot of offensive talent. You know, there's CJ McCollum is, of course, spectacular.
It's really just those top two, honestly, right, offensively.
And he's you know, his three-point percentage is down. His efficiency is down overall, 42% from the field, 34.8% from three. But, I mean, he's jacking 8.1 attempts per game, which from three, which ties his career high. You don't like to see his effective field goal percentage dip below 50, which it has for the first time in his career. But he's shooting over 92%. From the three-point line. You have to believe that his finishing around the rim will come up a little bit. He's always been kind of iffy around there, but 56.3% inside 3 feet is low for him. It's below his career average. And he's shooting 28.6% from the corners, where a large share of his three-point attempts have never really come. There was a minute in like 2014, 2015 where he was getting more of those looks, but he's always shot the ball well from the corners, like on those limited opportunities. Just before this season alone, he was well above 40% from the corners, and to have him kind of shooting 28.6% from them now, there's just some things that feel like they'll normalize on the offensive end, and maybe they won't, because the Blazers, they can shoot threes, and they're not like the league's worst three-point shooting team, but at the same time, they're just not, you know, they don't have a ton of these floor spacers. So the fact that they're 20th in offensive rating and that Damian Lillard's raw numbers have kind of suffered just a little bit, that doesn't really bother me, particularly when I think he's been a lot better on the defensive end.
Yeah, he's my second guard too. I've actually done a little bit of research on Portland's offense in recent weeks, because it is kind of weird that they're just, I just expect them to be better. It feels like the Blazers have been good offensively for a few years. A lot of it, at least from what I've found, is sort of tied to Yusuf Nurkic. He's well below average for a guy his size in terms of efficiency, and he's using a decent amount of possessions. So when Lillard is sharing the floor with Nurkic, it's nowhere near as pretty as it is when Lillard's on the floor without Nurkic. Just as sort of my first point, he is, Lillard, fifth in the NBA right now in wins over replacement player. I was going to mention sort of the dropped efficiency as well. But like you said, I agree with sort of all the caveats you laid out there. His raw numbers, 26 points, 7 assists, 5 rebounds a game for a team that's comfortably in the playoffs right now. I think the one knock on him has always been defense. And like you said, he's much improved there. So he is also my second guard. I'm going to jump to reserve forwards now. There's three reserve forwards as well. My first one is Jimmy Butler, who he took a little bit of time to sort of feel out what his role would be on this team. I think, thank goodness for the Timberwolves, he's kind of asserted himself more recently. There was, to me, no doubt when they first acquired him, that's Minnesota's best player now. I think it took a few games to sort of iron that out. But he's quietly pulled his averages up to 20 points, 6 rebounds, 5 assists. His shooting numbers are they started real cold, but he's starting to rehab that as well. He's inching closer and closer towards 60% true shooting. As soon as they can maybe convince Andrew Wiggins to take like 5 fewer shots a game, I think Butler's numbers will climb even more. So this is another one that's kind of weird for me because I have Karl Anthony Towns in here too, and I don't know about having two Timberwolves, but I think he is the one that's more comfortably in for me, Butler.
I would say by far. And do you know what he's averaging over his last 14 games? He's actually also my pick for first reserve forward. So we've been in lockstep thus far, 8 for 8.
Yeah.
Over his past 14 games, 24.1 points, 5.6 rebounds, 5.1 assists, 1.9 steals, 49.2% shooting, 37% shooting from three-point range. And that's just, I mean, that's just nuts. He's,
yeah.
It seems like they, all of a sudden, I don't know if it was, and it was more than 14 games ago. I feel like maybe it was like 15 or 16 or whatever it really was. It's tough to pinpoint. Something just clicked, and it felt like the Timberwolves were all of a sudden realizing that, oh, crap, Jimmy Butler's our best player.
Yeah, it was like, okay, we've given you – Jimmy was like, I've given you enough time to show me what you can do, Andrew Wiggins. Now it's definitely my team now.
Yeah, and over – so, like, over their last 15 games, they're outscoring opponents by 8.6 points per 100 possessions when he's on the floor. When he steps off, that they drop to a minus 22.9 points per 100 possessions.
Wow, that's –
that is like, it's just absurd. That's how important he is to them. And like, we've seen it in crunch time where at the beginning of the year, he wasn't particularly efficient. And this happened in the game against, they were playing the Blazers on Monday night, I believe. And he just gets to the rim and like players just go for his like head fakes or his just drives. And he's drawing fouls like crazy. And he gets them almost on command. Like for that to happen, it was, I don't know if you saw the picture of it. I posted on Twitter, but he had,
yeah,
three.
I did. I was watching that game too. When that happened,
he had three Blazers just like not even just like kind of leave their feet. Like Al-Farouq Aminu was reaching for the rafters. And it was just, Al-Farouq Aminu is a good defender, but like, you had three Blazers just like in the air crowded around you. He's been absolutely sensational, and I don't know, it kind of – I can't imagine, like – I'm not high on the Timberwolves. They're fifth in points scored per 100 possessions, but their shot profile is just god-awful. They're just – and even when you watch them – so – and this is the parallel I'll use. When I watch – when I look at the Pacers' offense on paper, there are some things that are, like, impressive, like what they do in transition, and they have a lot of guys shooting really high percentage from threes, but like they don't seem to take enough threes. They lead the league last time I checked, according to Cleaning the Glass, in long mid-range attempts. Like they don't look good on paper, but then you watch them and like the offense, like, oh, it kind of makes sense. Like, oh, Domantas Sabonis is just going to pop out and he's going to hit those 17 footers on command, so it's fine. I watched the Wolves and it's the complete opposite. Like, yes, their offense, despite ranking fifth in offensive efficiency, does not look great on paper. When you look at their shot profile and things like that, and then I watch them like during the, I'm like, nope, this still doesn't look good. So
yeah, it looks really clunky, that's for sure.
So I mean, Jim, and I don't know how long you're gonna go with using him this much, but I think he has to be in, and he would, depending on how much people kind of weight recency. Like if I was to pick someone who could get in over DeMarcus Cousins, it would probably be Jimmy Butler in the front court.
If he keeps this up, like the play that you laid out over the last like 15 games between now and the All-Star game, I think that's very much in play. My next one, I think this is where we're finally going to sort of take different paths. I have Karl Anthony Towns. I get the issues with his defense. There are times when he just looks like completely lost out there. And I think that's valid and fair to put in the discussion, but he's averaging 21 a game, 12 rebounds, shooting 38% from three, taking almost 4 threes a game. I mean, he's truly a stretch five. I just think what he does offensively is enough for me to overcome the defensive shortcomings. Like I said, I was a little bit torn about putting two Wolves on the All-Star team. I know they're in the playoffs right now, and they're actually
fourth
their record's
place.
Better than I thought. They're 18-13, so maybe I'm not as upset about this as I thought I was, but yeah, he's my second forward, and I know we might have a little divergence of opinion here.
Yeah, so I went with Paul George. I can't, and I'm probably just, Karl-Anthony Towns has been fantastic on the offensive end. Some of his counting stats are down, but like that happens when you look at just the personnel he's playing with. I can't overlook the defense. Like, I know the All-Star isn't necessarily, like, All-Star game isn't about defense. It's just so tough for me to overlook it. And I went with Paul George, who's controversial in him, like, by himself, just because he's not, like, he has not been particularly efficient from the field. In their win over Denver on Monday night, he went 3 of 13 from the field, but he just seems like. This is a situation that almost runs counter to what's going on in Minnesota. He's the Oklahoma City Thunder's best player, and they just haven't realized it yet. And on some nights, it looks like they do. And if you remove kind of like that 3 of 13 dud from the equation, he was playing like a little bit better over his last seven. 19.9 points a game, 5.1 rebounds, 3.6 assists, 1.6 steals. He was still shooting 37.1%. Overall, but he was hitting 45.7% of his threes, getting the free throw line fairly frequently. I'm a big Paul George believer. Leads the league in steals per game, still as well. He's a big part of why the Thunder have the defensive identity that they do. And again, it just seems like they've yet to figure out the offensive dynamic. And I don't know. Like, I feel Russell Westbrook might garner more consideration than him, and I'm just not for it. And it's tough to overlook how bad the Thunder have been. I think you can argue they don't deserve an All-Star. And if you just, you know, if they do deserve an All-Star, like if we're looking at them, like if we're stepping back and looking at the macro view, like Russell Westbrook still just matters incredibly so to this team. You look at their last.
Yeah, their net rating is still way better when he's on the floor.
Right, and you look at their last 15 games. They're minus 5.2 points per 100 possessions with Paul George on the floor, which is the worst mark of the big three, or the OK three, whatever you want to call it. So it's and Russell Westbrook's the only one of them to be a net positive. So it's just – it's tough for me, and maybe it's a little bit irrational, but like watching Paul George on defense is still super fun, and he still has these nights – where it just looks like to me, if he could get a larger share of this offense, or maybe if the Thunder didn't go one ball dominator like too deep, you know, like that win over the Timberwolves on December 1st, like where he has 36 points and 9 assists, like that's Paul George. And I there's an argument for Towns, but I would just go with Paul George. And in part, I tend to lean more towards players who can impact the game even in a positive fashion, even when they're not making shots. And Paul George, for a lot of this season, has been that guy, but I'm very much aware that the Thunder, my perception of them, and I think everyone's perception of them, kind of just flip-flops by the day.
Yeah, this is probably my hottest take of this episode of the podcast, and it might not even be that hot because I feel like a lot of people are talking about it, and you just mentioned it. I actually don't have a single Thunder player on the All-Star team. If I was like determined to put one in there, I think I would go with Paul George too. The counting stats for Westbrook are awesome, but I think he is maybe the biggest example of why you can't always trust statistical systems and like catch all metrics, because when you watch him play, I don't know if there's anybody I've ever seen who's more visibly like stat chasing than he is. So, and I think he often does it to the detriment of his team. Now, I say that acknowledging the fact that they've been better with him on the floor all season, like I just mentioned. So,
it's just like I'm with you, because it's what happened to like his free throw shooting. Like it's just so. Some of this stuff is just so, like, even the things that shouldn't be impacted by playing with George and Anthony, like the foul line. You're shooting 70% from the foul line. Like, that's not Westbrook. I mean, and
I still think this team can, like, figure it out. I think in their last win, Anthony had 6 shots, and they asked him about it after the game, and he's like, yeah, I'm fine with that as long as we win. Like, if they could get his shot distribution down to, like, maybe a 10 or 11 and – Paul George is maybe taking like 16 or 17, and I don't know how you convince Russell Westbrook to get down to 16 or 17, but if you can do that too, I think they'd play a little bit better offensively. But at the moment, like if I had to pick right now, I can't put any of them in there.
I think that's more than fair. My next reserve, and it's kind of just because I think you need to have a member of the Spurs, but also because he's been ridiculously good, LaMarcus Aldridge. 22.3 points per game, 8.4 rebounds, 2 assists. He's shooting 49.2% from the field, 35.6% from 3 on 1.5 attempts per game, which I believe ties a career high. It does. He's just been absolutely spectacular for the Spurs this season. And you look like at what their offense was before Kawhi Leonard came back, and it was they climbed all the way to 12th in offensive efficiency before his return, and like they are scoring on the season overall like a top five offense when LaMarcus Aldridge is on the floor. So for someone who hasn't been able to spend time with Kawhi Leonard much this season, and who's also, I mean, the Spurs have not been great offensively in the 48 minutes Kawhi Leonard has played this season. They're averaging under 90 points per 100 possessions. So like for him to still kind of like prop that up, it was, and I actually screwed those numbers up because I was looking solely at the last 15 games, but it was still the Spurs were scoring like a top six team when Aldridge is on the floor. So it's just like that's a big deal because he's feasting on a lot of tough looks, like these like long fadeaways, and he's just still remains. I don't want to say an anomaly when you're looking at what we value in analytics today, but he's still someone you're comfortable with. Oh, you want to shoot from 10 to 16 feet? Go ahead. He's shooting 40.2% between 10 and 16 feet, 41.5% between 16 feet and the 3-point line. The dude has just been a machine, and whatever talk he had with Greg Popovich this year that led to the Spurs giving him an extension, like it's working. And the last thing that I'll say that I've been like super impressed by is, and I feel like they haven't had a lot of time to hash this out, like even dating back to last year, but the chemistry between LaMarcus Aldridge and Tony Parker is just on point. They're just – the Spurs are absolutely lethal when those two share the floor on the offensive end. So I just – I like what he's doing for this team, and I don't know how you wouldn't put him in the All-Star game because the Spurs need to be kind of celebrated for their body of work without Leonard to begin with. But also Aldridge has actually played like an All-Star.
Yeah, I have him too. And I had like the exact same line teed up. Whatever was said in that conversation worked very well. All I will add is this is, I think, objectively the best season of LaMarcus Aldridge's career, which is saying something for a guy who's already been to five All-Star games. He's posting career highs in box plus minus, win shares per 48 minutes, player efficiency rating, so like three big-time catch-alls. This is the second-best true shooting percentage he's ever had. The only one was better was his first year in San Antonio. So it's been a pretty ridiculous season for him. He's also posting his most points per minute. He's averaging 24.1 per 36. I'm really interested to see how the dynamic between him and Kawhi sort of unfolds over the next couple of months. I don't know much impact on what he's doing right now, not enough to sort of knock him off my ballot. So he was one of my wild cards, but I had him on there.
He's also on pace to generate more total points off assists than he has since 2013, 2014, that like bonkers season he had with the Blazers. So that's just like – that's another thing. Like I know you're playing for the Spurs, and maybe that trend kind of goes down a little bit because Kawhi Leonard's back. But he's been a smarter passer overall, even though, I mean, you look at his per-game assist numbers, and they're like kind of in lockstep with last season and even his per-minute numbers. But it seems like he's just making smart decisions when it comes to finding guys who are beyond the arc.
All right, so my next forward on the spot as we're recording. I'm bumping Draymond Green – from a wild card pick up to my last forward spot. He's another guy that's been hurt, but I still think what he does for Golden State cannot be overstated. He's averaging 10 points, 7 assists, 7 rebounds, almost steals a block and a half a game. His field goal percentage is up almost 4% this season. He's up to 45. His three-point percentage still not quite league average, but 33 is enough to like make people go out there and guard you. He's still, to me, just sort of the engine of that Warriors attack. I know you could certainly make an argument that that's Curry or Durant, but he makes so much of what they do work. They're still, I think, despite what Houston's doing, and it's truly insane what Houston is doing, I still think the Warriors are the best team in the league, and I think he's a very much part of that. So he is my third and final reserve forward.
Yeah, I don't think... For front court, yeah, I mean, I have him. I also, he's your, because did you have a wild card that I used or something? LaMarcus Aldridge was your wild card. Okay.
Aldridge and I'll save my last wild card.
So my wild card is Draymond Green. So that's where we're at, because I had him in too, just because I think Aldridge – I'm probably just like, oh, we have to recognize a member of the Spurs at this point. Draymond Green has just been good, and he still gives the Warriors their identity on the defensive end. He does so much. He's, you know, Kevin Durant has like these crazy rim protection numbers, but Draymond Green still contests a lot of shots around the iron. He's chasing people around the perimeter. He's a far better perimeter defender at this point than Kevin Durant is. It's hard. He's one of those players it's hard to quantify how much he means to this team. I'm still firmly in the camp that Golden State is just made because of Curry, but on the defensive end, it's almost certainly because of Draymond Green. And quietly, like, even though Golden State just has not been even a little bit interested for most of this season in defending in transition, now they're third in points allowed per 100 possessions. And, like, you know, that's going to throw Green into the Defensive Player of the Year conversation once again by default. The Warriors are allowing 99.6 points per 100 possessions when he's on the floor. The best mark among starters not named Zaza Pachulia, which is spectacular. And it's like you said, if he's going to shoot 33% or better from beyond the arc, like, that's enough to just continue to respect him, and his passing is just out of this world. I know a lot of it's just the product of, like, he gets to fling these bullets on the move to wide open shooters or guys who are just going to knock down shots anyway, but this is a guy who isn't necessarily interested in scoring, and his effort isn't going to vacillate on the defensive end or as a passer no matter what. So his turnover percentage has been through the roof this year, though. But that's just like, I don't know, you play the Warrior style of basketball and you're almost willing to overlook those mistakes because you're making so many quick decisions. And the other thing I've been really impressed with, even though he's not like this high volume scorer, as you said, he's around 10 points per game for the second straight season, he's shooting over 75% inside 3 feet. That's nuts to me. Do you know what his career high mark was before 75.4? 68.7 in 2014-2015.
So this is a guy that, I mean, the reason he was in the second round is the lack of athleticism, and, you know, would he be able to finish around big guys?
Right, and I mean, he does like a for someone his size, but he's basically a big anyway. Like, he does a good job of just, he's going to barrel down there, but also you're going to have wide open paths to the basket when you're playing on Golden State. So, but still, he's been great, and I don't think three all-stars from Golden State, like, that's just fine. They're still, as you said, I think they're the best team in the NBA despite what Houston is doing. Maybe it's a more uncomfortable margin than initially thought, but I still think that gap exists.
My last reserve in the West.
All right.
Oh, go ahead.
I think we both have the same. What, is this a wild card?
I bumped him to wild card. I'm going with Clint Capella. I think it's fair to say, like, any rim-rolling big man could do this if they got to play with James Harden and Chris Paul, but his raw numbers are insane. He's averaging 20 points, 16 rebounds, 2.6 blocks per 36, shooting 70% from the field. In his last five games, he's shooting 85% from the field. He's missed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 shots in six shots in his last five games. And taking almost 10 shots a game in that stretch. So he's ridiculous. I think his case should largely be held up by what he's doing defensively too. I think last time I checked, Houston was better defensively when he's on the floor. So I realize I have three Warriors and three Rockets on the team, but I have to reward the two teams that are just clearly the best in the league.
I have Capella too, so I'm obviously not going to take any issue with what you said. They're actually worse defensively with him on the floor this year by slight margin, 103.7 points per 100 possessions with him compared to 101.2 without him. But I still, you know, we're talking about a guy who 323 of his minutes and his two most used lineups include playing with Ryan Anderson, who has been targeted in isolation and is not getting destroyed. I get it, but, like, you're still playing with Ryan Anderson, and James Harden's in there too. Like, James Harden hasn't been this great defender.
Did you hear what Ryan Anderson did last night?
I'm not sure that I did, because I'm going to say no.
I heard this on a different podcast. It was, and I didn't see the report, but it was Josh Lloyd, the Locked On Fantasy podcast, said that Anderson asked to not start the second half because of how bad he was defensively. And he didn't. they started PJ Tucker instead of him in the second half against the Jazz last night.
I did notice that, and PJ, I noticed that he didn't start. But I saw, first of all, PJ Tucker has been nuts. But the other thing, and this is totally unrelated, that Jazz like Rockets game was just completely crazy. Like there was like
those
billion
last
lead
5
changes.
Minutes were
like,
insane.
Yeah, that was a good game. Kudos to the Jazz for
that's
a
good.
Fight.
Yeah, that's a good example of how good Houston is. Like, Utah kept it competitive for all but those last 5 minutes. And I thought in that game, like, this is the first time in the last 2 or 3 years I've watched another team and thought they had, like, the Golden State Warriors switch, where they can just turn it on. Anyway, that adds to why I have three Warriors. I'm going to run through a list of contenders that I left off, and you tell me if there's anyone you want to spend some time on. So these are snubs for me in the West. Nikola Jokic, anyone who follows me on Twitter knows how much that hurts me. Russell Westbrook, Paul George, DeAndre Jordan, Mark Gasol, Tyreek Evans, Klay Thompson, Steven Adams, Pau Gasol, Gary Harris, and CJ McCollum.
I'm surprised you're uncomfortable leaving Mark Gasol out.
Yeah, that's true. He probably shouldn't even be on my bubble because he's been almost bad this season.
The only one I'd be like kind of uncomfortable leaving off would be Nikola Jokic is like the one that I still grappled with. I know he missed some time, but we put Steph in there who has missed some time. I also think it's great that you can mention Tyreek Evans and not be kidding because he's still been like crazy.
It's crazy how good he's been, yeah.
If you were going to pick someone, like it would be Jokic over Capella would probably be the one to get bounced. I don't know who else.
That's probably what I would do too.
So, but that's like really the only one. And I kind of see the argument like against him just because it took a while for him and Paul Millsap to figure things out offensively. Now we have to see how he's going to perform back from his sprained ankle without Paul Millsap there and what the Nuggets defense is going to look like. He's still been great. Like he's at 15.3 points, 10.6 rebounds, 4.4 assists, 51% shooting, 39.7% from three. And a part of me almost regrets including Capella just because of like what Jokic actually means to the Nuggets. And he's not as dependent on everyone else around him offensively as Capella. It's like, in fact, the other way around.
That's a good point.
I don't know if he spoiled us towards the end of last season because his numbers are just eerily similar.
I was going to say, the more we talk about this, the more I like feel like I might have made the wrong choice between these two.
Yeah, I kind of feel like I might agree. I think Capella, it's like that DeAndre Jordan situation where he kind of just takes you off guard. So Nikola Jokic is a snub, and we will gladly accept. You know, like we could even say screw size, and I would put him over. You had Karl-Anthony Towns, and I had Paul George. I'd put him over that. Let's just run with all bigs. Throw out the all big lineup in the Western Conference.
One thing on Jokic, I actually just looked this up today. Over the last two seasons, Denver's 44-36. He starred on the team when he comes off the bench. It's just weird to me that Michael Malone is like bringing him off the bench as he like comes back from this ankle injury. I'm doing it. I'm making the switch. Jokic for Capella.
I guess I could make it too. Jokic for Capella, but now I just feel like we're copping out. Like now we're just going back and making. I'll list off what I think are no-brainers in the Eastern Conference. Starting guard, Kyrie Irving. Starting forward, LeBron James. Starting front court. I got to stop saying forward. The F really just Fs me
That's
up.
That's what I keep saying sorry. That, too.
Starting front court, LeBron James. Starting front court, Giannis Antetokounmpo. And I have a fourth one, starting front court, Al Horford. I don't think there's a case against him, to be honest. And I just want to point this out. And Kyrie Irving, again, has been fantastic. But in the 230 minutes that Kyrie Irving has played without Al Horford, the Celtics are scoring 101.6 points per possessions, allowing 109.2 points per 100 possessions, and are minus 7.5. Now, in the 222 minutes Horford has played without Irving, so we're looking at like almost identical sample sizes. Irving played 230 without Horford. Horford's played 222 without Irving. The Celtics' offensive rating is a 108.7, defensive rating of 99.8, net rating of 8.9. That's how important Al Horford is to the Celtics. So he's very comfortably a no-brainer for me. And that's like, I don't know who, if you have, I can't remember if you have all those four or if they're all no-brainers for you.
Yeah, those actually would say those are all no-brainers too. I switched this before the pod, and I'm going to go ahead and make him a no-brainer as well. My entire starting five for the East is now a no-brainer, and I'm adding Victor Oladipo to that conversation as well.
He's in my starting lineup as well, which is one, I spent much of the beginning of the season saying that his breakout was just not sustainable.
Yeah,
so,
I was ready for a drop-off at some point too.
But he's just been lights out in isolation and on pull-ups, and he's been fantastic in transition. Yeah, he's just doing literally everything. I think you could comfortably make an argument that he's a no-brainer, but I honestly, I'm not sure if we're talking enough about Kemba Walker overall. He would probably be the guy that
Walker and Lowry are the two that, like,
the thing that does that Lowry wouldn't be in the starter. I mean, he could be. I wouldn't, if you said Kyle Lowry starts over Victor Oladipo, like, I wouldn't throw a hissy fit. But is that he started off the season so freezing cold from the field, and like Kemba and Oladipo have just been doing this all year. And but I think Oladipo deserves to be in the starting lineup. And right now, I think you could say all of these are no-brainers. I'm very curious to see how the media and fan voting unfolds in the East front court. Like, are we just like without Horford specifically because Giannis and LeBron are in, but I'm curious
yeah, they're
to see
in
if
for sure.
I'm curious to see if like people get like Ben Simmons or Kristaps or Joel Embiid drunk or something like that.
Probably there's still like a general, maybe not negative, but certainly skeptical view of Al Horford. People still say, oh, he can't rebound, and, you know, he doesn't score enough for a guy who has that big of a contract. But
I hate people. FYI.
It's clearly a no-brainer to me. You also mentioned Kemba Walker. I have him as a reserve. I think we've mentioned this stat a few times on the podcast. I know I've mentioned it in the stat threads on Twitter. Charlotte's plus 124. In the 986 minutes he's played, they're minus 168 in the 464 minutes he's been on the bench. Charlotte has been a disappointing team. You certainly cannot fault Kemba Walker for it.
No, you cannot. And I don't. He's been spectacular anyway. So, he's right up there, and I think he would be close to the starter conversation. He's certainly a no-brainer reserve guard for me. And I don't know if that kind of like coalesces into it. I have my first two reserves at the guards are Kyle Lowry and Kemba Walker.
I had Lowry. You mentioned his struggles to start the season, but he's recovered very, very nicely. I'm pulling up his numbers now as we speak. His true shooting percentage is already back up to 0.598, so almost at that magic number that I mentioned earlier. His points are a little down. He's averaging 16 points, 7 assists, and 6 rebounds. But I think he's still clearly Toronto's best player. I'm amazed that there are still a lot of people out there who go with DeRozan on that question. I don't think there's any question about it. He was my first reserve guard. And then my other one was actually a guy that I was kind of torn on just because of the amount of time he's missed. But I went with John Wall. I just think the Wizards being just such a completely different team when he's on the floor and just the raw numbers that he puts up year after year after year, I had to give him consideration as well.
You put him over Kemba?
I have Kemba as a wild card.
Unacceptable. I have John Wall as a wild card for the same reason, just because he did miss some time. He had the PRP injection in his knee, but the Wizards is just like – they're still so dependent on him offensively.
Maybe it's not fair of me, and I'm like, Charlotte being 11-19 is just such a disappointment. And like I just said, it has nothing to do with Kemba. If you just look at those on and off numbers, it's very clearly problems elsewhere. But I was just trying to rectify as I was making up these teams, like what sort of records do these teams have, and I knocked him
so
for that.
What is the point of factoring in team success when it doesn't, like when it's not your fault that your team sucks? I'm honestly I'm just curious. Like I
that's
get
a good question.
It's just I get the whole best player on like best team or really good team, which is why you celebrate the Rockets and the Warriors and why you need to have a spur or something like that. But I just, I don't know. I just look at what Kemba Walker has done. It's not egregious to say Wall, because he's been, and it's amazing to me how dependent that the offense is still just on him. And it was apparent when he was out. Like the Wizards were kind of close to average when Bradley Beal was running the show statistically, but like they were like that all bench mob that Scott Brooks kind of unearthed was like blitzing people like on offense, like more so than the starting lineup. So John Wall is a good pick. I had him as a wild card. And Kemba
I'll also say that
the reserve
Kemba's shooting has dropped off quite a bit in recent weeks. I actually haven't checked it in a while, so when I saw this, it kind of surprised me. But he's shooting 33.2% from three. I'm not sure that justifies or answers the question that you just raised for me. But I think it's like a coin toss between those two.
Yeah, I mean, his efficiency has dropped, but like it's just at some point it's – you know,
I mean, he's clearly the end all be all for that team.
And his
has been their problem.
Did he come back too soon from his shoulder injury too? Is probably the other thing. It's since he came back, 9 games shooting 36.6%, 26.9% from deep. And do you know what the best part is? That he's still like a plus 4.4 on average per game because he's still so important to what they do. Just the mere threat of him. And it's rough because the Hornets aren't like they're not stocked with all these other offensive weapons either, and that's just going to make life on Kemba. So like you have Jeremy Lamb's been really good, but Nicholas Batum is dealing with some elbow stuff and still doesn't look right. I think while Dwight Howard has been good, I still think allocating post-ups to him makes your offense a little bit too predictable. So
Dwight Howard is like the third best center on that team by a couple of different stats. Kaminsky and Zeller have both been better than him, at least in terms of like efficiency. But anyway, go
ahead. Well, I mean, Kaminsky, the type of competition he's going up with against.
Absolutely.
It's just, you want to make a case for Zeller. He's always been like super important to them. I still think it's a coin toss because Wall hasn't been particularly efficient himself. Like the offense still kind of like zings when he's on the court because he's John Wall. But
I think he helps an offense in a different way. Like I've never looked at John Wall as a guy who's going to boost you because of his shooting. What he does is like a pedal to the metal point guard that gets those kickouts, and he's just a much different type of value than Kemba is.
No, that's I think it's totally fair. Moving on to my front court reserve, I picked DeMar DeRozan, who, per Cleaning the Glass, has spent a lion's share of his time at small forward this year. He's just been, I think, understatedly good. The lineups that don't include Kyle Lowry with him now, a lot of them are net pluses. He's averaging, last time I checked, what was it, like 5 assists per game or something crazy like that. So he's been absolutely fantastic. The knock against him is still his defense, but the D for the starting lineup with OG Anunoby is kind of stabilized a little bit. I also don't think it helps that like I'm still not a fan of the Ibaka Valanciunas front court pairing. Like it's just awkward defensively. I don't like that he still can't hit threes. He's shooting them more than ever, or close to more than ever. He's at 2.4 per game, and he's at 2.5 per 36 minutes overall, which would tie his career high. He's still the fact that he's this spectacular of a player and doesn't have that reliable 3-point stroke, or even just, I mean, maybe this year it's different because he is shooting better on long twos. He's at 42.2% between 16 feet and the 3-point line, but he's also cut out like a ton of those looks. 37% of his shots came from there last year. 18.4% are coming from there this year. He's traded in those for some 3-pointers, and now he's getting some more looks at the rim. And he is shooting more between 10 and 16 feet, where he is hitting 50.3% of his shots. And like he's just money from 16 feet and in. I love watching him, and he's the type of player I think I could say toward the end and even like middle parts of Kobe Bryant's career, I didn't necessarily like watching him. But like DeRozan is just like a lot of what he does seems a little smoother. And I'm not trying to knock Kobe Bryant, but DeMar DeRozan is just so smooth.
Don't let Kobe Bryant fans get a hold of that.
He is in the Lakers rafters now. Two of his jerseys are retired. And Magic Johnson called him the best Laker of all time during the ceremony, which is just unequivocally not true. Polarizing,
tell
maybe.
Me you saw some of the back and forth between me and Kobe fans yesterday.
I did.
they are insane. Man, as you laid out that DeRozan case, I don't have him on my Eastern Conference All-Star team, and I kind of feel bad.
Excuse me. Sorry.
Now that you made that argument. But this is like, I think this is year seven in a row, six or seven, that Toronto's been like comfortably better when he's not on the floor. And obviously there's a lot to that. That
comfortably.
They've had really good benches. Like the net rating is usually like four. I haven't looked it up in a while for this year.
No,
but.
For this year, they're still, I guess that's like the case again. I sometimes can't get over that too, but like that gap.
What is it this year? Do you have it?
So when he's on the court, they're a plus 8.2 per 100 possessions. When he's off, they're plus 8.7. The other thing, their offense, like it's.
That's a lot better than it was the last time I checked.
Yes,
sure.
And it's suffering when he's not on the court. They're averaging 103.9 points per 100 possessions when he's off the floor. That's the lowest mark of when anyone on the floor steps off. Anunoby and Lowry are basically tied for the second lowest marks, and they're at 107 and 107.1 respectively when they step off. So he's just been. I get it. It's very weird to say, but. You know, it's almost like that. They've just been deeper. Like, okay, so here would be my point. They're a plus 8.4 per 100 possessions with Lowry, and then they're a plus 8.3 without him. So they're just deeper this year, and I think
that's true.
You can attribute that. But I do like your point is just the fact that we're still talking about
for
them.
6 or 7 years.
Yeah,
straight
it's a long
it's
time.
Pretty wild. I think the guy that you left off that I put on, and this is going to be kind of funny coming from me because the stat we just used. It does not look good for this next player either. But Andre Drummond, I've mentioned this on the podcast many times, I think. I just love big guys who can pass. And for him to suddenly be one of those guys, after there was almost no evidence through his first four seasons that he would ever be someone to pass the ball. Suddenly he's averaging over four assists for 36 minutes. He's like, it's crazy to say this, but it's like, almost Nikola Jokic territory in terms of like his actual passing isn't as good as Jokic's, but just the output is insane to me. And then everything else is still there. Like he's averaging 16 rebounds per 36, 15 points. His free throw percentage amazingly is still over 60. He's almost 63% from the line. We talked about this before we started recording. It doesn't help my case for Drummond that Detroit's actually been better with him on the bench, but I just think overall he's been really, really good this season.
Like,
so he was one of my front court reserves.
That's like a team-wide problem, though. Like Detroit, we were talking about this before the podcast.
That starting lineup just has not really worked for them this season.
No, and when you look at it, five of their seven most used lineups are demonstrative minuses. And the one thing I'll say, though, is so of those two that are positive – not one of them includes Andre Drummond. So it's just
not helping me.
And meanwhile, their team is just so bizarre. And Stan Van Gundy called him out the other week, was like, I need them to play better. And I thought Andre Drummond's defensive effort, I thought, was a lot better this year. And it's just, I don't know, it kind of seems like it's not as, or at least not over the past like 7 or 8 or 10 games or so of what I've caught from them. He's still been spectacular. The passing thing is incredible to me. And the giving up post-ups.
I just never could have seen that coming.
Right, and I think that's his biggest case. It's just apples and oranges with him and DeMar DeRozan. I'm going to tend to favor wings, especially when you kind of look at some of the other picks we have coming up in this. But he definitely has a case. I'm not – if it came down to including him over – maybe we could talk about this afterwards, but I'm looking at who I have as my next four picks. I don't know who I would put him over, though, and that's like a legitimate – I guess it's three because we already talked about
– I was going to say, I only have three left.
Yeah, so I guess on that note, I'll move on to my next front court reserve, which is – I have Ben Simmons. It would be the first rookie to make an All-Star game since Blake Griffin. I don't necessarily know how you pick against him. The dude,
I was
going to
say, you
like,
can't leave him off at this point.
He's not even like, well, I shouldn't say he's not, he's just good. And his instincts are great, and he has so many different ways to score and make an impact, even though he's not a good shooter. And I think we should probably like point out that like it seems only recently did his finishing just become like absurd. Like he's shooting over 73% inside 3 feet of the basket, and he really just knows
and
how
he just like it. Dunks everything. It's crazy. Right.
And I don't know. He's so good. The passing, he's probably already. Where would you rank him if you just? I know this is put. Where would you rank him as a passer in the NBA? He's like top seven
he's
passer. Top five?
I was about to say top five.
Yeah, I mean he's there. He grabs a good amount of rebounds. He's active on the defensive end. Gets caught out of position a lot, but he's averaging 2 steals per game. And his length it really just helps there. The minutes without Joel Embiid, that's something I like to watch for because the Sixers haven't been great during them. But if you've given him like the opportunity to play with JJ Redick during those times, the Sixers have basically been like a net wash, which is when you know how much Joel Embiid is just meant to the Sixers, is impressive. I think you have to pick him, and he's not having like an historical season relative to just rookies. Like his stat line.
That's what I was going to say.
Yeah. So it's just unique in general.
Yeah. He's, he's been absurd. I actually ran this for, this morning. He's played 28 games. He has 487 points, 251 rebounds, 220 assists, and 57 steals. The only other player in league history to hit all four of those marks through the first 28 games of the season was Fat Lever in 1988-89. And that was Fat Lever's seventh season in the NBA. So like you said, it's not just like incredible compared to other rookies. It's like almost unprecedented compared to anyone. And then the last thing is, if you just compare those two seasons, Simmons this year and Lever in 88-89, through 28 games, Simmons has 25 blocks. Lever had 6 through the first 28 and 88-89. So he's adding a fifth. I mean, he literally does all 5 of the major counting stats. It's remarkable to me. And the fact that he's – one thing I thought he would struggle with, I always kind of thought his first few years would be like 6'10 Jason Kidd. That was the comp I always went with and sort of – included in that was the fact that I thought he'd shoot around 40% from the field. For him to be at 50 overall is just crazy to me. I didn't think he'd be anywhere near this efficient.
It helps that the Sixers just have like viable shooters now, like with Covington and Redick. And then even that Embiid, he's not shooting well from three, but he still fires away. So like those pathways are going to be open a little bit, but he's been, you expected maybe him to, even if you expected him to run away with Rookie of the Year honors because he was this red shirt rookie and he had like the all year to kind of get his body NBA ready and was around the team. So he kind of starts ahead of the curve. It just you don't foresee this. Like he's exceeded even a while. And he's done it without shooting threes. Like his
nine all year.
And
yeah.
8 of them are heaves. 8.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
So it's just like he's taken one legitimate 3-point attempt all year. One.
So I think it's pretty like well known that I am like very, very much for the 3-point revolution. But at the same time, I think it's cool what Simmons and Antetokounmpo are doing this year. Awesome. Showing that like you can, I mean, you got to be freakishly athletic and way too big for a point guard, but there are ways to survive without hitting threes.
I'm hoping the next step for Simmons is kind of developing like a really nice floater because he's not. I looked the other day, he was shooting like 3 of 14 on floaters for the season, which is just not good, but that would be just a different. That's like, it's just different things to kind of like negate the fact that you're not even going to try and attempt jump shots. Like so less than 5% of his shots come from 16 feet or further out. It's just like, so it would be nice to have like, but he doesn't need it right now. And it's like you said, like it's nice to kind of see him and a guy like Antetokounmpo dominate. And the other thing I'll say before you roll out your next pick is the kind of cool thing about the past few years where Draymond Green's been getting all these counting stats or you have Ben Simmons, is we get to just remember how ridiculously good that Fat Lever was because he always seems to like come up in all of these searches.
Yeah, he's, I think, very, very underrated. I'm going to make a switch.
He finally had retired his jersey. That took a little while.
I'm making another last-minute switch. I'm making Joel Embiid my last front court reserve. You mentioned how much better Philly's been with him on the floor. His basic numbers are crazy. Let me see. 24 points, 11 rebounds, 3.5 assists, 1.9 blocks. His three-point shooting is way down this season. He's down to 26%, and the turnovers are still historically high. And I just can't, I can't quite figure out why he's so bad about turning the ball over.
He holds onto the ball too long, like in the post sometimes. He's a really good passer,
I don't understand how they haven't like figured it out yet. But overall, like I've run the numbers on this a bunch of times this season. When him and Covington, who is actually one of my he's on my snubs list. When him and Covington and Simmons are on the floor together, that team is really, really good. And I think, like you pointed out, I think the sort of king of the hill on that is Joel Embiid. So he's my last forward reserve.
He was my wild card pick, in part because of the turnovers and also a little bit in part because of the three-point shooting. It's just... what is he at? He was at 26.2%.
26.
Yeah. So that hasn't done, but he made it. He was my wild card pick. And I personally would not, especially now that we've seen him play like that triple overtime thriller against Oklahoma City. And we saw him play like 39 minutes a couple days before that. Like, I know he's a guy that you still need to rest, but like now we've seen him just play through these long games and still be really good. I'm just not, and the Sixers are still so dependent on him. And if you look, they're still not this net plus when he plays without Ben Simmons. But when Ben Simmons is off the court, the Sixers are it's a sample size of 102 minutes where Joel Embiid has played without Ben Simmons this year, and the Sixers are still just barely a net plus. And like you can't say that. For Ben Simmons, they're plus five, so it's like nothing crazy. But if you swap that, like they're a demonstrative minus when it's just Simmons. So I think he's still as good as Simmons has been. And I think I also should note that the Sixers have outscored their opponents by 117 points total when those two have shared the floor. But as good as Simmons has been, like Joel Embiid is still their most important player. And the fact that he's putting up just some of these numbers and is still so important when you look at the on-off splits, despite not kind of leveraging like a consistent three-point stroke, he's still going to shoot them, and we've seen him hit a couple big threes this year, but he's just so good. So I don't really have any qualms about it. My pick, though, for the reserve spot is Kristaps Porzingis, and I'm wondering how, if that pick will look crazy, will it turn out that he's like missed a bunch of time because he keeps getting these different ailments, and his latest has already forced him out of two games, but when you look at what he's doing in the situation that he's in, and there are just a lot of circumstances that are new for him, or maybe not new, but not ideal. So you don't – now all of a sudden you're the alpha option, and your efficiency has actually improved compared to last season, and you're playing out of position. You're still being predominantly used as a power forward. You're not contesting as many shots at the rim as you were last year, and yet you're still probably the league's two or three most valuable rim protectors. I mean, 25.5 points per game, 6.6 rebounds, which is it's rather unnoteworthy for someone who's 7'3", but he's also, again, playing power forward and having to chase around these guys who can handle the ball. That's not going to be conducive to grabbing a lot of rebounds. He's slashing 46.5, 39.5, and 84.8, which is absolutely great. All of those are career highs, by the way, as like his first season as an alpha. He's done a better job, even though the assist numbers will probably never be there. He's done a better job of passing out of double teams, and he's not a guy who turns the ball over a lot. He's recognizing when he can really just shoot over players, and he has to do a better job when teams rotate centers onto him. He has to make quicker decisions there and know to take them off the dribble more. But one of the benefits of actually playing him at power forward is you have this guy who's 6'9 or 6'10 or even 6'11 trying to guard him. He's just going to rise and fire. And he's been absolute – I'm not crazy about the volume with which he's kind of shooting from, I call it, DeMantis Sabonis range at this point. But he's at 50.4% between 10 and 16 feet, where almost 28% of his shots are coming from. And the final thing I just kind of want to emphasize is like – he's good at protecting the ball for someone. His usage rate is almost 34. His turnover percentage is under 10. So it's just like I think you can turn to him. He's a legitimate superstar, and it what kind of pulls me to put him, I guess, over Embiid a little bit would just be the fact that this is like kind of a new situation, even though it's his third year, and the fact that he's thriving, and that the Knicks are, as of right now, have a better record than the Sixers, if we want to play that card, which we won't, because I don't think that'll last. But it would be Kristaps for me, and I don't think, some people might actually be mad that he's not in like in the starting lineup, but like it's LeBron and Giannis, and Al Horford has to be a no brainer. So Kristaps is my pick here.
Yeah, Porzingis is my last reserve as well. You obviously don't have him as a wild card. You had him as a front court player, right?
Yes, I had Embiid as my wild card, and that even feels
I could maybe put like Embiid and Porzingis and Drummond into a hat and pull all three out. And what I'm saying is they're like interchangeable. I wouldn't have a problem with Porzingis being in one of my front court spots. The numbers you laid out, he's been ridiculous as a number one option. Over his last 12 games, he's down to 20 points, 6 rebounds, shooting 43% from the field and 38% from three, which is still
he's good. Down to.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's pretty crazy to say it that way. He's been ridiculous this season. I still think the lack of rebounding and maybe that's the one reason I'm knocking him. But like I'm being very, very nitpicky. I agree with everything that you.
The rebounding is probably never going to go away too. Even if he plays center, he's just never been a good rebounder. But I definitely think this season it's been kind of exacerbated by the fact that, well, first of all, Cantor just gobbles up everything.
He's a big time rebounder, and I feel like I was kind of alone on this all season, and maybe some people are starting to join me, but I actually like the Porzingis Cantor fit. It may shock some people, but I actually put him in my, like, towards the end of the list, but he was like in my contenders for like a snub spot. As I try to rationalize that, he's 45th in the league. So he's not close, but wins over a replacement player. He's been solid. My actual snubs in terms of Eastern Conference, I have Otto Porter, Robert Covington, Nikola Vucevic. Bradley Beal was one that I was actually really torn over, especially with what he had to do to carry the team while Wall was out. Kevin Love, I think it was a pretty big snub. Aaron Gordon, Chris Middleton felt like a pretty big snub to me as well. We talked about him a little bit before we started recording. Jason Tatum, who this is another thing we talked about. He is
he's not missing three-pointers.
Not missing three-pointers. He's 25th in the entire NBA in wins over replacement player, which is just insane to me. Who else did I have? I already mentioned DeRozan, who I left off. Goran Dragic. I think that would pretty much round out my snub list.
The East snubs are just harder to reconcile for me than the West. Like, I think you look at Kevin Love is a pretty big one.
Yeah.
Otto Porter and Covington don't bother me because they're still kind of dependent on other people offensively. And Porter is just not – Porter's a good defender, but Covington's a great defender. So that I guess, Covington bothers. But Porter's probably the better self-sufficient option on the offensive end. Aaron Gordon, if this was like a month ago, would have made me feel uneasy.
Yeah, if they could have been like half of what they were for the first six games, Vucevic and Gordon would have had interesting cases.
Beal – and I think Beal and Kevin Love are the ones that are going to make me most uncomfortable. And I want to be uncomfortable with Chris Middleton because I thought he would have been an all-star this year. His slow start kind of hurts him. I don't buy into what the defensive numbers kind of say, some of them, when he's on the floor for Milwaukee. And they've just been, you know, since that Eric Bledsoe trade, they've been kind of like lights out anyway.
They've been very good, yeah.
His scoring profile has like kind of upped too, so those three are like tough. I think you could put, I don't know who you would replace though, but I think there's probably,
yeah, that's the thing,
there's a case to be made more so for Beal and Love than anybody else. And I'm not sure who I'd bounce. Maybe it's Kemba because of his kind of recent slump, although you know I'm bullish on Kemba's defense too, so you know I won't bump him. Maybe it's DeRozan, depending on like how you feel about the defensive end. Because Simmons is relying on, if we're just talking about real life, because Simmons is relying on like a reserve case, it might hurt him. So yeah, maybe he would be the one. But those are tough ones. But I think I'm comfortable with our selections. I mean, we were pretty much in lockstep. Who did you feel most comfortable leaving off, though?
Leaving off or most uncomfortable?
Most uncomfortable just leaving off, like from that list. Oh, yeah. Because that snubs list is pretty, like,
most uncomfortable.
Illustrious.
I'm with you on Beal and Love. And I'm actually.
Do not say Canner.
No, I was going to say I'm higher on Middleton than it sounds like you are.
I mean, I'm team Middleton, but I guess I just expected him to dominate this season.
He's averaging 20 points, 5.4 rebounds, 4.5 assists. And despite the, like, really bad start shooting, he's up to 47% from the field and 36% from three. Really, the only thing that's dragging him down stats-wise is defensive box plus minus, which, as I've mentioned on here a couple times, Basketball Reference actually says if the player's reputation tops what he's doing defensive box plus minus wise, you can just throw it out. And I haven't watched Middleton this season to know if that's like totally the case, but I've watched him plenty in the past when he was like a really solid on-ball defender, and maybe that slipped a little bit, but his raw numbers to me are really impressive. And any three of those guys, really, I would not be. I know I tried to make the case for Andre Drummond, and I'll still keep him here for now. But any of those three, Beal, Love, and Middleton, taking his spot wouldn't like crush me.
Yeah, I mean, and Middleton's part of some of the Bucks' like best defensive lineups too. He's also part of some of their worst, but there's like,
and like you said, he's been so good since they've had that three together. So
yeah, him when you put him Bledsoe and Giannis on the court at the same time, the Bucks are outscoring opponents by 12.3 points per 100 possessions. The upshot there is, though, and I'm wondering if Bledsoe kind of has an effect on this. Because he's like a good defender and he's lanky, but do you trust Brogdon a little bit more on that side? Because that three-man unit is coughing up 105.7 points per run.
They need to play those two together. Just play Brogdon at the two.
They've experimented with that like a little bit, where you've had like all of those guys on the floor, and the defensive returns have like been not pretty aesthetically from what I've seen when they've been there. And I'm actually looking it up, and oh. And this is one of those times where the eye test aligns with the stats test. Antetokounmpo, Bledsoe, Brogdon, and Middleton have shared the court in 10 games for a total of 86 minutes. Their defensive rating, Andy, 122.1.
Ooh.
So, but yeah, I mean, it's
the maybe East they don't just need to experiment, like, but they definitely need more minutes. But
right, you have to. I mean, that's like that might be one of your best lineups one day. Yeah. So, I'm with the snubs in the East made me far more uncomfortable than the ones in the West. Like the only.
DeRozan. I also have DeRozan out, so that's why.
Oh, you should feel terrible. Yeah.
Too. Yeah. I think that wraps us up. We went through all 24 guys that we have going to the All-Star game if it was up to us, and a ton of snubs too. Hit us up on Twitter if you think any of our calls were ridiculous or any of our snubs were ridiculous. You can find Dan at Dan Favale, Favale. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show is at Harvard Knox. The host site is at NBA_math or NBAmath.com. That's where Dan posts all the pages for the episodes. As always, subscribe to the show, leave a review, rate us. Over the holiday weekend, I need to do a better job of this than I did at Thanksgiving, but commandeer friends and relatives' phones and rate us on there. They won't even notice because you can like steal it for 2 minutes and get it done and get it back before they even notice. Anyway, all those ratings help us. And until next time, we leave you with the shout out to Beno Udrih.